He has fought tenaciously, doggedly, against what he sees as injustices all about him, with a kind of courage few of us command, and with great good humor and very obvious compassion. Revolution is made of strange stuff. For if our moral tradition believes what it pretends to believe, this incarnation of wisdom and courage and industry and selflessness and humor ought to be the object of admiration of all of our time. And perhaps particularly of you. For whom it is perhaps less important that Dr. Ellis is a member of this or that learned society, editor of this or that journal, author or editor of some 25 books and 250 publications. Rather less important these, I say, than that he is one of those very few who, exemplifying these virtues, helped to make possible the personal freedom, partial though it may be, in which you live. It is with the utmost pride that I present to you this afternoon Dr. Albert Ellis, who will speak upon the topic to which he has devoted much of his life, sex without guilt. Dr. Ellis.
I'm very happy to be here for the second time speaking at Michigan State. I'm very happy to see that the walls did not crumble as a result of my first visit here. I'm going to speak to you tonight, as Professor Walsh said, on sex without guilt, but today it's going to be the theory rather than the practice. As we begin to approach the last quarter of the 20th century, there is much less of a tendency than there ever was before among our publicists and preachers to encourage individuals to be guilty about their sex lives. Sexual relations in marriage are, of course, looked upon as being good and noble, in fact, as being almost obligatory. Masturbation has been given a clean bill of physical and mental health and is no longer deemed to be causative of psychosis, cancer, and the bubonic plague. Homosexuality is often seen as innocuous, although you naturally wouldn't be exactly wild about your sister marrying a screaming faggot. And even covert adultery and good, honest wife swapping are increasingly accepted in certain civilized parts of Long Island. In regard to premarital sex relations, however, American attitudes are still highly ambivalent. To be sure, Vassar girls sometimes clamor for the prescribing of the birth control pill by the college health clinic. And Life and Look magazines, encouraged somewhat by Margaret Mead's latter-day espousal of trial marriage, publish photos of young university couples who are openly living in so-called sin. But only a small minority of the populace is actually engaging in free love. And as Arno Carlin points out, a good many of the supposedly convention-defying partners in college shakeups seem so terribly middle class. What is more, Carlin notes, quote, ventures in love and sexuality could be a joyful part of a joyful life. They needn't be life engulfing and glum. I almost wish someone would take much of that unmarried vanguard by the hand and show it the joys of guiltless promiscuity, unquote. The fact is, therefore, that literally millions of Americans, including untold numbers of college students, are still exceptionally guilty in regard to sex in general and to premarital sex in particular. Is this good? I say as definitely and as unequivocally as I can that it clearly is not. Guilt, when accurately defined, is virtually always irrational, self-defeating, and evil. In relation to sex behavior, it is particularly idiotic. I've spent a good part of the last quarter of a century crusading against it, and I expect to continue doing so for a few more decades. If I get a suitable heart transplant. Why is guilt of any kind, and about sex in particular, needless and stupid? Because the feeling that we call guilt consists of two important elements, and although the first of these two elements is sometimes sane and useful, the second is almost invariably insane and self-sabotaging. When this second element is eliminated, our guilt feelings practically vanish. The first and rational element in guilt is the observation that I have done a wrong, erroneous, mistaken, or unethical act, and that it is unfortunate that I have committed this act. This is often a sane statement since A, there are fairly objective reasons why my act may be wrong. For example, it will needlessly harm me or harm others in some specific ways. And B, since my wrong act will in all probability lead to certain bad or inefficient consequences, it is obviously unfortunate that I performed it. If, therefore, I acknowledge my error, feel sorry about making it, and take some steps to prevent my repeating it in the future, I am behaving pretty sanely about it. My sense of wrongdoing leads to the feeling or emotion of sorrow, regret, or displeasure. And this feeling, in turn, helps me to correct my future behavior and to commit fewer wrongs. The second and irrational element in guilt is the conclusion that because I unfortunately committed a wrong act, I am a pretty bad person. More concretely, this conclusion really tends to mean that because I have done a wrong deed, A, I am the kind of individual who will always keep committing such deeds, B, I am therefore rotten to the core, C, I consequently deserve to be cruelly punished for my misdeeds, and D, if there is an afterlife and a hell, I certainly shall roast in it for eternity. None of these statements are empirically founded, nor ever can be factually sustained. They are essentially theological, definitional propositions, and if I believe them, it is only because I choose to do so, and not because they logically follow from the fact of my wrongdoing. What is far more important, these unempirical, definitional value judgments about myself, which are the philosophic essence of self-deprecation and guilt, rarely enable me to correct my mistaken behavior, but instead often tend to help me exacerbate it. For as I have shown, in Reason and Emotion in Psychotherapy and several other books, once the human individual condemns himself, his person, for his misdeeds, he tends to become obsessed with what a worm he is, to believe that a louse like himself cannot change, to find new pathways too risky to try, to compulsively keep making mistakes, and otherwise to focus on everything except calmly accepting himself with his execrable performances and then trying determinedly to improve those performances. Although an honest admission of wrongdoing helps him to modify his future behavior for the better, an intense sense of guilt and sin serves to fixate him in the same ineffectual and anti-social acts. The feeling of guilt, then, is not simply, as the dictionary often wrongly defines it, quote, the act or state of having done a wrong or committed an offense, unquote. It is mainly, if we are truly honest about it, our profound feeling of being a rotter, a skunk, a horrible person for doing this wrong or committing these offenses. It is an intense state of self-denigration, and more often than not, it is severely paralyzing, depressing, and conducive of defensive dishonesty and continuing irresponsibility. For every individual who is guiltily driven to change his behavior for the better, two or three, perhaps many more, are probably impelled or compelled to act essentially worse. My main therapeutic thesis for the last 15 years has therefore been that while a sense of wrongdoing may greatly help an individual to lead a personally improved and socially related life, a deep feeling of guilt or sin will usually encourage him to put himself into a hell on earth and to stop progressive change. No matter how wrong he is, I still insist that as a fallible human, he has a right to be wrong. And if we were truly wise, we would never condemn him in toto for his mistakes, but would merely point out how self-destructive and life-sabotaging these errors are, and how he could calmly go about correcting them. In the realm of sex, perhaps more so than any other contemporary mode of living, it is dubious that most so-called errors, wrongs, or sins are truly mistaken. For by wrong, we mean that an act needlessly harms oneself and or needlessly harms another person. And exceptionally few premarital sex behaviors are in their own right in this category. Not that fornication doesn't have its dangers, for it does. If one is foolish enough, for example, one can become pregnant, catch a venereal disease, or lose great amounts of sleep from copulating before marriage. But of course, all these dangers, especially pregnancy, exist in marriage. And life without dangers might be very sweet, but it would also tend to be a damned bore. Besides, many modern sports are far more risky than premarital intercourse. Witness, for instance, horseback riding, skiing, surfboarding, and that most dangerous of all sports, riding in automobiles. As I have realistically noted for many years, no one has probably ever broken a leg or been thrown through a windshield while fornicating. When moralists, therefore, declaim about the so-called enormous dangers of premarital sex, Why don't they add some equally cautionary words about skiing and automobiling? A second set of objections that is often raised against premarital sex is that it leads to anxiety, guilt, feelings of hurt, and sorrowing about loss of reputation. This is an extremely foolish argument since it consists of circular thinking. It says, in effect, that if you deify virginity, if you convince yourself that you are a weakling or a nincompoop for losing it, if you are nutty enough to believe that you simply must marry every member of the other sex with whom you go to bed, and if you inordinately care about what other people think of you and are willing to sell your soul to gain conventional people's approval, then you will suffer from sexual experimentation before marriage. Well, of course you will, if you insist on being such a ninny. What is more, if you cravenly follow this self-denigrating philosophy to its so-called logical conclusion, by refraining completely from premarital sex, it is highly likely that you will A, never truly love or marry at all, B, pick a fascist or a dullard for a partner if and when you do marry, C, have a highly restrictive and guilty sex life after marriage, D, remain incompatibly married for the rest of your life for the same cowardly reasons that you rigidly adhered to convention in your premarital days. E, longingly dream forever of the delectable wild oats that you asininely missed. And F, reap many other grim rewards of your premarital ignorance, unadventurousness, and dire need for others' approval. A third set of objection to the pleasures of fornication takes the form of allegations that it sabotages first the general state of marriage and second specific marriages of those individuals who engage in it. As to the first of these objections, it is palpably groundless since innumerable cultures exist, including our own, where premarital relations are widespread on both a sanctioned and an illicit basis, and where the state of marriage obviously has hardly withered away. In fact, as premarital sex has increased in the United States, the proportion of individuals who marry has also increased, and there seems to be a still growing trend in this direction. As for the hypothesis that premarital sex leads to frigidity or impotence during subsequent marriage and to general unhappiness in marriage, there is no good evidence to sustain this belief. Lots of highly conventional people who abjured non-marital relations, of course, report that their marriages are very happy. But as I pointed out almost two decades ago in a critique of studies predicting success in marriage, the same individuals who are ashamed to have premarital sex are also frequently ashamed to admit how miserable their marriages really are. So their reports are pretty worthless. Some research evidence and considerable clinical data would tend to indicate that modern couples who try sex, particularly with each other before marriage, have better sex lives after mating and are less prone to corrosive disillusionment than those who enter the marital state in complete sexual ignorance. The main reasons given by relatively sane and objective authorities today why premarital intercourse is wrong and self-defeating are those which concern its relationship aspects. According to these authorities, some of whom are surprisingly liberal about other aspects of life, sex before marriage is evil because it leads to the exploitation of one's sex partner and to the sabotaging of certain fine human values. Let me now consider some of these neoliberal objections in more detail to show how specious they are. One, it is often objected that in the course of premarital sex there is, in Bingham Dye's words, quote, too much emphasis on sex apart from interpersonal relations. I found that among undergraduates, many still seem to emphasize sex apart from interpersonal relations, unquote. Assuming that Dr. Dye is correct about large numbers of college students emphasizing sex apart from interpersonal relations, what is so awful about that? Undergraduates frequently go boating, eating, church attending, politicking, picketing, camping, dancing, fishing, skiing, studying, hot car riding, chess tournamenting, and on a host of other mutual activities without their really relating to each other interpersonally, and no one seems to think anything of this. Why then should they have to engage in intense depth-level interpersonal relationships just because the activity they are engaging in happens to be sexual? This is not to ignore the fact that it is fine and proper for young people, and for that matter, older people, to be aware of each other as humans, to be considerate, to be kind, and to try not to mislead or harm each other. Certainly, it might be a good thing if in practically all respects, even when they engage in a game of tennis, people realize that their partner is a human being with purposes, ideals, and feelings, and not merely someone with whom they are playing a game. But let's face it, they usually don't keep this fact very much in mind, and they usually do use or exploit, in quotation marks, the other person, with his consent, of course, for their own sport-playing purposes. What is more, he usually uses or exploits them in pretty much the same manner. That may be deplorable, because if they behaved otherwise and fully accepted the other person as an individual rather than as someone with whom they are merely playing tennis, they would have more intense and presumably more experiential and enjoyable relations with him. But the point is that they do, more often than not, have highly superficial relations with the people with whom they work, study, converse, plan political action, and go to bed. Now, why should we excoriate them for engaging in limited sex relations, to which they are often driven, incidentally, for biological reasons, which are much stronger than those that drive them to play tennis, when we do not insist that they engage in most other activities on a deeply humanistic, closely related basis? Two, ever since Martin Buber propounded his idea of the enormous difference between the I-thou and the I-it relationship between people, innumerable well-meaning individuals, particularly liberal clergymen, have been stating or implying that any person who has an I-it rather than an I-thou relationship with a member of the other sex is exploiting, in quotation marks, this other, and that therefore he is immoral. Since I-thou relationships are presumably more likely to exist in marriage than in non-marital affairs, at least in theory, if not in practice, these Buberites insist that premarital sex is wrong and evil. This is no place to criticize Martin Buber's philosophy in detail, although I may well write a treatise on it one of these days. The main points that I want to emphasize here are that the anti-sexual citers of Buber are not exactly reading him correctly, and that when they do, they are taking his views to impossible and unrealistic extremes. On the first of these points, let me know that Buber is not really opposed to what he calls I-it relationships. Thus he states that, quote, the world of it is set in the context of space and time. The world of thou is not set in the context of either of these. The particular thou after the relational event has run its course is bound to become an it. The particular it, by entering the relational event, may become a thou, end quote. And he says, and in all the seriousness of truth, hear this. Without it, man cannot live. But he who lives with it alone is not a man, unquote. And once again, quote, the communal life of man can do more than man himself dispenses, can no more than man himself dispense with the world of it, over which the presence of thou moves like the spirit upon the face of the waters, end quote. What Buber seems to be saying here is that life consists of I, thou, and I, it relationships. That the I, thou is a special kind of relating which is uniquely spiritual and perhaps in a sense better than the I, it mode of being, but that man cannot live by I, thou relationships alone, that these tend to become I, it processes. And that since some I-it affairs become I-thou relations, the former are a necessary background for the latter. If this is true, then Buber strongly implies that man would better have sex, love, or I-thou involvements in the course of which he truly cares for his sex partner, and that he'd also better have non-loving sex adventures in the course of which he mainly cares for his own pleasures and honestly uses, in quotation mark, his partner without necessarily harming her or denying her the privilege of using him. Although Buber clearly apotheosizes love and marriage, he hardly states or implies that all non-loving and non-marital relations are wicked and worthless. Throughout his work runs the reasonably sane notion that I-thou relationships are ideal, and that an individual would better strive for some of them during his lifetime. But when his so-called followers insist that all premarital, and for that matter, marital sexuality, be an integral part of an I-thou feeling, they are clearly out of their heads. For humans are simply not the kind of beings who always love the people they lust for. And to demand that they should do so is to help make them guilty and self-defeating. As I have noted in some of my other writings, moreover, not only do sexual feelings frequently stem from love emotions, but sex also begets love, particularly in the male of the species. Consequently, innumerable love and marital relationships would never occur if males and females did not first become sexually attracted to each other and at first lovelessly jump into bed together. After they begin to enjoy each other sexually, and sometimes after a considerable period of time has gone by, they frequently become enamored of their partners, and consequently, the more good, honest sex for sex's sake affairs they have, the more I-thou relationships they are likely to engage in. If the anti-fornicators who hide behind Buber's skirts want to face the facts of life, which very frankly I do not think they really want to face, they'd better admit that most of the time legal marriage itself is far from being an I-thou relation. For the most part, married individuals take each other for granted, exploit one another shamelessly, and use each other's bodies for their own very selfish purposes. The primary word, I, thou, Buber states, quote, can only be spoken with the whole being. The primary word, I, it, can never be spoken with the whole being. End quote. Married couples rarely speak to each other with their whole being. Normally, they speak with a mouth that requires to be heard, a hand that insists on being held, or a genital organ that demands to be sheathed. This is not to say that it is wrong for a love or married partner to primarily be interested in his or her own desires, and only secondarily to be absorbed in the preferences of the mate. For it is self-interest rather than selfless love which truly makes the world go round. And I doubt whether we would be a wiser or emotionally healthier race if it were not so. The point still is, however, that I-thou encounters are almost invariably few and fleeting, while I-it encounters are the warp and woof of human existence. For anyone, therefore, to denigrate a premarital affair because it is not truly a totally unexploitative I-thou relation is for such a denigrator to be quite unrealistic and perfectionistic. 3, many neo-Puritans insist that premarital intercourse is only good when it is part of a meaningful or worthwhile relationship. Thus, when a Barnard College co-ed who shared an off-campus apartment with a male student was threatened with dismissal recently by the college administration, the Jewish and Protestant chaplains at Columbia University defended her and defined the crucial question as whether or not the relationship is meaningful or worthwhile. On the face of it, this seems to be a very liberal standard of sex morality, particularly for a member of the clergy. But actually, it is arbitrary and impractical. In the first place, why must premarital sex only be engaged in within the framework of a so-called relationship? If I want to have a sexy one-night stand with a girl and she equally wants to have it with me, why must we significantly relate to each other except sexually in the course of our joyride? Because a Jewish and a Protestant chaplain at Columbia University said we must? Why, unless we want to include them in some kind of an orgy, should we ask their permission? In the second place, why ought any premarital relationship be meaningful or worthwhile in the sense that these two clerics clearly use this phrase? Suppose a female wants to play the game of bouncing bed springs with me once a week. Just because she and I have a mutual interest in this indoor sport and do not really like or love each other. We obviously have a relationship, which the dictionary defines as a connection of sorts. But why are we vermin? Because our relatedness is not very close, meaningful, or worthwhile. Besides, in our own way of looking at things, since we clearly do define Simon pure sexuality as distinctly meaningful and worthwhile, for why else would we go to the trouble of arranging and having it for an hour or so each week? Who is legitimately to contradict or negate the meaning and value that we give to sex for sex's sake? Certainly not two highly prejudiced chaplains. 4, it is often contended that premarital sex relations are anti-spiritual. Thus, Cain writes, quote, "It is probable that every one of the world's great religions from time immemorial would subscribe in principle to the idea that sex without love is a sin, an estrangement from that which is most ultimate to the individual and his spiritual life. Even humanists, agnostics, and atheists would agree, I think, that loveless sex is a contradiction in terms and a violation of a psychological principle. Most religions, indeed, regard sex as a sacrament, an expression of divine love, and God's instrument for propagating his creation, end quote. To back up his point, Cain quotes from 1 Corinthians in the Bible, quote, "Because you are created in God's image and your body is God's temple, it is good in every way. Help others, especially the young. Dispel confusion and self-deception by reminding them that the body is a sacred trust for which each person is accountable to God, that every bodily power has its own noble purpose, that human beings must keep their impulses in constant check through self-discipline, that man actually worships God through the proper use of his body. Do you know that you are not your own? For you have been bought at a great price. Glorify God and bear him in your body," unquote. Dr. Cain's statement is so full of unmitigated rot that it is truly surprising to see it come from the pen of a member of the American Psychological Association. He assumes first that an appeal to the world's great religions, by which presumably he means Judaism, Christianity, and Mohammedanism, is a valid appeal to an intelligent and sane person. He forgets, however, that in addition to subscribing to the principle that sex without love is a sin, these noble churches also heartily endorse and have endorsed for centuries murder, assassination, torture, religious wars, political holocausts, sadistic acts of God, racism, nationalism, simony, bribery, avarice, dogma, censorship, superstition, suspension of critical thinking, and hypocrisy, anti-scientism, errant masochism on the part of their followers, and virtually every other evil act that man has ever invented. Secondly, Dr. Cain assumes that virtually all humanists, agnostics, and atheists would agree that loveless sex is a contradiction in terms and a violation of a psychological principle. As a member of the American Humanist Association and the American Association of Humanistic Psychologists, and as one of this country's leading atheists, I, for one, certainly do not agree that loveless sex is a contradiction. If anything, the reverse is often true, since some sex partners love their mates so much and themselves so little that they fail to concentrate adequately on their own sexual arousal and satisfaction, and consequently miss out on considerable satisfaction. Loveless sex is no more a contradiction than is loveless marriage, loveless business partnership, or loveless golfing together. It is usually, though not always, very nice and highly desirable when two sex partners love each other and go out of their way to bring each other to orgasm, but it is hardly necessary for their true enjoyment that they mutually care. Although I personally prefer sex with love, or at least with friendship, to loveless dalliance, I must admit that some of my most exciting, interesting, and downright glorious copulatory endeavors have been with a female for whose immortal soul I frankly didn't give a damn. But the memory of my exhilarating physical contact with these individuals is in some cases still very much with me. And I wouldn't want to surrender these images, not to mention the tastes and smells, for the memory of many other relatively dull sex encounters with girls I supremely love. If Dr. Cain's or anyone else's virtuosity does not extend to the ecstatically physical, as well as the arousingly amative extremes of the sexual spectrum, I can only offer him my sincere condolences. Sexualized love is truly one of life's greatest boons, but loveless sex is another consummation devoutly to be wished and occasionally at least to be captured. As for loveless sex being a violation of a psychological principle, I wonder what the devil Dr. Kane means by that. The main psychological principles that I recall in regard to sex and love, after spending a quarter of a century as a clinician, researcher, and writer on the subject, are that A, love, in spite of the notions of the libido crazy Freudians, clearly exists without sex. That B, sex, in spite of the ideas of the agape crazy clerics, clearly exists without love. And that C, sex and love very frequently and delightfully coexist. If Dr. Kane has lately discovered some astounding new psychological principle that belies these time-honored, empirically rooted postulates, I wish he would marshal his specific theorem and its supporting evidence and rush into print with it. Meanwhile, I shall stick to my sexological guns and believe what history and clinical observation seem to denote. Thirdly, Dr. Kane somehow assumes that the individual's preoccupation with his spiritual life is indubitably a worthy purpose, and that sex unquestionably is, quote, a sacrament, an expression of divine love and God's instrument for propagating his creation, unquote. According to my Webster's New World Dictionary, spiritual is defined as, quote, of the spirit or the soul, often in a religious or moral aspect, as distinguished from the body, end quote. Sacrament is defined as, quote, something regarded as having a sacred or holy character or mysterious meaning, unquote. Now, Dr. Kane and all the religionists he cares to quote may believe as much as they wish that sex is sacred and holy, and that it was invented by God for the purpose of propagating his creation, and that man has a spirit or soul which is entirely divorced from his body, and that he is nobler and wiser when he becomes preoccupied with the spirit and experiences physical pleasure only in a highly subjugated way. But their believing these hypotheses hardly gives such theories any plausibility or validation. As a scientist and an atheist, I prefer to believe that such hypotheses are clearly unprovable and that they are most probably hogwash. As a highly experienced psychotherapist, moreover, I have considerable reason to suspect that dogmatic belief in any kind of supernaturalism and that preoccupation with the realm of spirit rather than full acceptance of the joys of the flesh is more than a little nutty. And that, in fact, intense and orthodox religiosity is little more than another name for what we ordinarily call severe emotional disturbance or mental illness. The essence of emotional health would appear to be open-mindedness and tolerance. And Dr. Kane's and other religionists demands that every one of us must give up loveless sex for devotion to God and spirit, or else we are clearly inveterate sinners and presumably headed for hell, is the height of intolerance. As a secular humanist, I strongly object to this kind of bigotry. Let me note finally in regard to Kane's position on sex, love, and marriage that if anyone today really followed 1 Corinthians and believed that his body was not his own, that it was bought at a great price, and that he had to glorify God in order to copulate with his girlfriend, mistress, or wife, he would be suspected of being entirely off his rocker and in need of protective custody in a state hospital where, in accordance with today's somewhat barbarous rules, he most probably would be restrained from having sex relations with anyone except possibly the Holy Ghost. Five, one argument against premarital sex relations that one would no longer expect to hear today, but is still surprisingly extant, is the idea that to desire to possess another solely for the physical satisfaction it gives is one of the lowest animal nature. Such a desire makes a farce out of the most important and wonderful beatitude human beings can experience. Only a few weeks ago, when I was speaking at the Boston Community Church, a minister from another congregation berated me severely for my book, Sex and the Single Man, and contended that I was advocating pure animality in it and was thereby leading young people on the road to perdition. Well, why is animal nature low and hellish? Every one of our senses is clearly rooted in our animality and the sensory receptors that enable us to enjoy sexual fondling and coitus are hardly essentially different or lower than those which enable us to enjoy eating, watching a sunset, hearing a symphony, or smelling a rose. Man, whether we like it or not, is an animal. And he damn well better make the most of his animalistic sensations if he is to have a ball and is to enjoy the so-called higher things in the course of the one relatively brief lifespan he'll most probably ever live. A good many other objections to premarital sex relations are still bandied around today. But for the most part, they fall under the headings I've just examined. None of them present evidence of why such relations are truly wrong, and almost all of them ignore the reasons why it is often very right. For as I have shown elsewhere, fornication has many clear-cut advantages. Thus, A, it provides release from tension and from sexual obsession and preoccupation resulting from needless restriction and frustration. B, it enables the unmarried individual to become sexually experienced and competent. C, it supplies risk-taking encounters that help a male or female to know himself or herself and to stop catastrophizing about the assumed horrors of living. D, it is one of the best available pathways that is left today for adventure, experimental, and interpersonal experiencing. E, it offers practice and training that can easily help the individual to choose a suitable marital partner and to enjoy better sex love relations with this partner. F, it tends to prevent the occurrence of serious and crippling sex deviations such as fixed and exclusive homosexuality. G, it combats the hypocritical double standard of sex morality that encourages and it encourages true democracy and equality between males and females. H, it puts a halt to unfair discrimination in favor of sex participation only for married and not at all for unmarried individuals. I, it provides for healthful and joy-producing varietism, which is highly desired by a large number of members of both sexes. This is not to deny again that premarital intercourse has distinct limitations and disadvantages. Of course it has, just as all human relations, including love, have their inconveniences and drawbacks. Practically anything man does has its joys and sorrows, its blessings and its regrets. Why should non-marital coition be any different from other human endeavors in this respect? Premarital sex, again, like every other imaginable human act, can definitely be performed stupidly, self-defeatingly, and antisocially. When, for example, an individual copulates only with dumb Doras or mainly has one-night involvements, he is probably being stupid, for he is then gaining one form of satisfaction, to be sure, but missing out on various other forms that could be equally or more satisfying. When a person spends inordinate amounts of time having affairs or has intercourse with members of the other sex who are likely to be diseased and refuses to take prophylactic precautions, he is self-defeating. When someone induces a partner to go to bed with him by falsely promising to marry her, or when he engages in an act of rape, he is clearly being antisocial. These kinds of premarital sex are all mistaken, wrong, or immoral, not, however, because they are sexual or fornicative, but because they are performed in a certain self-sabotaging or inhumane way. It is practically never a sex behavior which is wrong or sinful, but only the manner in which it is performed. Assuming that a sexual deed is wrong, irrational, or unethical, my stand would still vigorously be that the individual who performs it need never feel guilty or self-deprecating. If he were truly wise and sane, he would acknowledge his act and convince himself, A, it was mistaken and foolish of me to commit that act. I am terribly sorry that I did it. Now let me work very hard to change my thinking and behavior so that I probably won't repeat it in the future. If he stuck to this sensible set of beliefs about his act, he would feel a sense of wrongdoing, would feel very regretful, but would not feel self-denigrating or guilty. It is only when he foolishly goes on to be and convinces himself, it was terrible for me to commit that wrong act. I absolutely should not have done so, and am an utter louse for doing what I should not have done, that he makes himself feel needlessly guilty and upset. He then brings on a host of neurotic feelings and symptoms that, as I noted in the beginning of this paper, will usually cause him to become more inefficient and compulsively attached to wrong behavior. In conclusion, a serious sense of guilt or sin about any kind of sexual act is irrational and self-defeating. Sexual behavior is only wrong or unethical when it can be clearly shown that it needlessly and specifically harms the individual engaging in it and or other individuals. Even when it is decidedly wrong, it is not, except by silly definition, awful, horrible, or catastrophic. Consequently, there is no point in the individual's blaming or defaming himself about his potential or his actual sexual wrongdoings. It is too bad that he does them, but he is not bad and condemnable as a person for doing them. Although sexual error or immorality is somewhat objectively determinable, lambasting a human for his errors is a tautological, definitional and theological construct, and one that almost always does much more harm than good. Thank you.
On behalf of Michigan State University and all of those participating in the colloquy on sexuality, I'd like to thank Dr. Ellis very much for talking to us today, and I'd like to thank all of you for attending. Hope we see you next week.